Transportation Committee.
And I open up the hearing for the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor for September... What is it? 16th, 2013.
I'd just like to let everybody know Lee Beyer, who normally chairs this, his wife is having some surgery, so I am taking over the chair position today. And we have quite a few absent, but we're going to make do.
Thank you. To start out, because this is all informational hearing, we have, for those who don't know, the reps and the senators, if the senator or the reps could go through and introduce themselves, and then Senator Grock could do the same thing for the senators. Starting with Mr. Freeman.
Good morning. I'm Tim Freeman. I represent House District 2, which was parts of Douglas, Josephine, and Jackson County. I'm currently serving in my third and last term in the legislature, and I look forward to being on this committee during the interim.
Thank you.
Jim Thompson, House District 43, which is McMinnville city limits down to the Lane County line, except Corvallis and Philomath.
Bill Kenmer, House District 39, can be in much of rural Clackamas County.
Good morning, Brent Barton from House District 40, Oregon City and Gladstone. It's nice to be down here.
Paul Holby, State Representative, District 8, South Eugene, Veneta, and South Central Lane County.
Kim Thatcher, representing District 25, Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh.
Good morning, Representative Shamia Fagan. I represent House District 51, which is North Clackamas and East Multnomah County, comprising outer southeast Portland, southwest Gresham, a little bit of Boring, Damascus, most of Happy Valley, and some unincorporated Clackamas County.
Okay. Brad, you want to introduce yourself?
State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31, principally Columbia County. Also the northern portion of Washington County and Highway 30 from Sobeys Island into Northwest Industrial Portland.
Hey, and I'm Representative Margaret Doherty from Tigard in Southwest Portland. Senator?
Go ahead. Okay. Chuck Thompson, Senate District 26, representing Hood River, Multnomah, and Clackamas Counties.
I'm Fred Girard. I represent rural Marion County and Clackamas and Lynn County. But I'd just like everybody to take note, it only takes two senators to equal all these representatives here. So, anyway, it's going to be informational today.
Would you please use your hammer in the appropriate way?
Yeah, whatever.
That's
it.
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a list of who we're going to... Okay, Patridge. Mm-hmm. Okay, Rob Patridge, please.
We'll bring the team up, I think.
Yeah, Merle Lindsay as well.
And so just everybody knows for this informational hearing that we asked for the OLCC that deals with what kind of introduced our from our interim chair to our new chair and get some background information and also talk to store agents. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Doherty and Chair Girard. For the record, my name is Rob Patridge. I am the chair of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission as recent as a week and a half. So I'm happy to be here today. With me today is Merle Lindsay, who's our executive director, our interim executive director right now. As many of you may have read or seen, we've had some dynamic and interesting times at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission over the course of the last year. We've had a longtime executive director resign from the OLCC. Our leadership in terms of commissioners has changed over rapidly as well. So we have we now sit with four commissioners out of the five that we would normally have. Our chair just recently resigned, and the governor appointed me. See, I knew better than to have
a phone. $25.
Yeah, $25. But The chair just recently resigned from the OLCC, so we have three of our four commissioners currently serving less than 3 years on the commission, which is an unusual thing for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. So we certainly are in the midst of leadership things happening at the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. We've also had some major department heads within the OLCC change over. So that's where we sit in terms of personnel and staff. We're also in an environment within the state that we've seen privatization on our Washington border, which many of you are aware of. We've seen an uptick of almost 20% in our sales along the Washington border as a result of that, which is about $16 million in revenue to the state of Oregon, which you all spent very effectively this last legislative session to continue to move forward. We also face a lot of interesting cultural changes and times, both in the regulatory environment as well as the environment related to where we're going as a society and culture in terms of the choice opportunities that are available, as well as a strong move not only in liquor but otherwise to localize things and local sales. And we've seen a blossoming of craft distilleries in the hard alcohol business, as well as continued growth in the craft beer and wine, our craft beer industry predominantly, but a lot of vineyards as well. So we face an interesting time culturally, as well as we also look towards marijuana and potential regulation that being thrown towards the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, as it has in Washington, depending on whose measure or what the legislature may choose to do. So we're certainly in a dynamic environment that we're trying to swallow, certainly on a rapid basis. This morning we were asked to come before you today to talk with you a little bit about the Oregon Liquor Control.
Mr. Patrick, you can sit back a little bit.
Okay. Sit back.
Oh,
am I blasting you?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's one thing the legislature has, very good microphones.
All right. Sensitive microphones.
Yes, thank you.
But certainly we're trying to give you an overview this morning of kind of the current state of affairs, what OLCC has done to continue to be dynamic in recent history, as well as kind of the path that we are headed down into the near future. So with that, we'll turn your – oh, also at your at the dais this morning, I think we – Representative Freeman, I apologize that we didn't get – yours correctly, but I think in front of each of you this morning, we have tried to kind of capture at least the revenue that is in your local counties as well as cities that occurs directly as a result of liquor sales in Oregon. I think that you guys each have a copy of that, as well as we've tried to provide information about agents locally in your counties and cities, so that if you ever wanted to reach out to those people related to anything related to OLCC, I'm sure that the agents would be very, very happy to hear from each of you. So we've tried to provide that information, and if we didn't get it right, we apologize, and please let us know. We'll try and keep refining this down. It's not easy to transfer legislative maps to agent maps, but we tried the best we could. So with that, we'll go to the PowerPoint presentation we have this morning. As you can see, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission is a substantial contributes to the Oregon's economic growth by fostering business, enhances community livability, and continues to reinvest in Oregon. We have our gross revenue of over a last biennium of $1 billion in gross revenue. You can see by the chart, 95% of that is distilled spirits. About 4% of that is privilege tax for beer and wine. About 1% in licensing fees, and a tenth of a percent in other revenue. Just so you have an understanding of what the budget expenditure looks like over a biennium for the OLCC on that $1 billion worth of revenue, our operations over a biennium are about $4.18 million. You can see that the state, in this case, eats the credit card fees. They're not passed on to the agents. That's $8.3 million. And then in liquor agents' compensation, there's $83.2 million going out to liquor agent compensation in the state. So we wanted to share with you a little bit about our net income distribution and how that works. You can see the largest portion of that being two $225 million going into the state general fund, about $49 million for city revenue sharing, $70 million for incorporated cities, $60 million for mental health. The Oregon Wine Board gets about $565,000, and then $35 million to counties. Just so you understand maybe a little bit about what goes into the average price of a bottle of liquor and how that gets spent, you can see that our average price is $15.70. 37% of that is profit for the state and cities and counties, which is about $5.81. Then we'll just go down. 5% is about the OLCC operating expenses. 8.8% goes to local liquor operators. And then 49% goes back into the cost of buying the alcohol, typically. So just so you have a historical perspective on tax in Oregon and what's happened, you can see that you have a distilled spirits markup, and then you've got some recent history from 91 to 2013. Then we've got the beer tax from 1977, and then we've got wine. I don't need to go over all the details. You have that lined up in your presentation. I believe you all are receiving a copy of that. So I'd like to talk to you a little bit. We've done a lot of exciting things at the OLCC in terms of recent history, and our executive director is going to cover some of those things. But recently we are trying to address retail innovations in terms of the OLCC and its availability to bring... Its availability to bring... the court's mics are not this sensitive, so... Even though the legislature's invested a lot in courts, but retail innovations in terms of... We're trying to get to retail innovations in terms of what we're going to do to continue to look at optimizing revenue for the state of Oregon, to continue to pursue the joint goal of public safety, and also to embrace the issues related to consumer choice in the interim with the changing cultural markets for consumers out there with liquor. So we're trying to attempt to do that, and so we've put together a retail innovations group. Initially what happened was, I was appointed the chair about a week and a half ago. We had a meeting here at the Capitol. We brought in about 20 people, everyone from the agents, the manufacturers, agents, the grocers, and everybody was invited to the table to have a discussion about retail innovation and ideas. It was just kind of a brainstorming session where we tried to put that piece together here at the Capitol. We had about 20 people in attendance, a little more than 20 people maybe. Yeah, it should have been the 5th, sorry. Yesterday was the 15th, so it wasn't yesterday. So it was a diverse group of individuals who have an interest in shaping Oregon's alcohol system. We've tasked this retail innovation group to look at all aspects of the liquor system in Oregon and to look at innovative ways to meet customer needs. They're supposed to identify the opportunities to strengthen and enhance customer service and preserve stewardship and public safety. So at the last OLCC meeting, which occurred last Thursday, we adopted this retail innovations group. We're going to appoint 13 members to the retail innovations group, representing the 13 areas that you see. We have a handout, which I believe that we gave copies and which may be at the dais for you now. But we've tried to group together a group of 13 to try and represent those people who are stakeholders within the liquor industry as we move to look at retail innovations in the near future. The task for that group would be to really try and take a look at the regulatory environment we have and to come back to this group and the legislature if there's anything that's going to require legislative approval outside of a rule change. Am I still talking too loud? I feel like I'm being stalked or something. Can somebody keep an eye on her?
Not paranoid, but they are out to get you.
So we have a very, very aggressive calendar. for this retail innovations group. We're going to try and have six meetings before November 26th. November 26th is your deadline for legislative council drafting. If there are ideas that this group comes up with, then we will approach the committee chairs and the committees ahead of time to talk to them about potential inclusion in the November or in the February session. But we would try and get all that in by November 26th. In order to do that, there are a lot of things we can do within our own rules at OLCC, but we certainly want to continue to include the legislature as we proceed with those items. So I'm going to toss the ball to Executive Director Lindsay and let him do it, and then we'll conclude and then open for questions at the end.
Thank you.
I think I have a much softer voice, so I probably won't have trouble with the microphone.
You're fine.
Chair Gerard, Chair Doherty, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Merle Lindsay. I am the Interim Executive Director for the Oregon Liquor Commission. This morning, I'm going to present some background information about the current retail model for sale of distilled spirits in Oregon. First off, our contract stores sell spirits to by the bottle to our consumers, and they also sell spirits to our licensees, people such as bars and restaurants that sell to consumers for by the drink. Our Board of Five Commissioners has responsibility for appointing independent contractors to operate our liquor stores. These store owners, in turn, employ about 1,000 additional people to help in the facilitate the sale of spirits here in Oregon. You can see from the slide that we have 148 exclusive stores and 100 non-exclusive stores.
Could you define exclusive versus non-exclusive, please?
Very good question. Our next slide. No. Exclusive stores are what people generally think of when we refer to a liquor store. They are standalone stores, and their primary business is the sale of spirits. Now, in addition to the sale of spirits, they also have a related items that they can sell, and it's in a rule, those related items that they have the ability to sell through their stores. Things like tobacco, mixers, lottery, glassware, those things that are associated with distilled spirits. Most of our exclusive stores are located in metropolitan areas. They have a large enough consumer base that they have the ability to operate as a standalone store, and you'll find them in, again, the major metropolitan cities. Turning next to our non-exclusive stores, these are stores that sell spirits but also operate in conjunction with an adjunct business. These are often located in our smaller communities, and because of the small consumer base that they have, they need to operate in conjunction with another business so that they have a viable business going. And you'll find those in the smaller rural communities. One of the things that we tried back in 2004 was called Store in a Store. The commissioners approved a pilot project in 2004 to test liquor outlets in a modern, convenient shopping area. This morning we have a couple of one agent and one store owner that can probably speak best to what their experience was at this store. The pilot project ended in 2006, and out of the three store-to-store test projects that we had, the Bethany and the QFC, or Bethany at QFC and Lamb's Thriftway are still in existence. Our Ben store was so successful that they, in fact, converted to an exclusive store. They moved out of Ray's Food Market and moved into their own outlet because of the success of the sales in that particular area. Got a picture here of inside Lamb's Thriftway. They opened up in August 2004 and have about 800 square feet of retail sales space in order to sell spirits. Next slide we have is a picture of our Bethany QFC store. Randy operated around 826 square feet for sale of distilled spirits, and in that 826 square feet, he had 1,382 SKUs, stock keeping units, so bottles for sale to the consumer. I have the challenges sheet up here, and I'm going to defer to let Mr. Guerra and Mr. Lamb speak to the challenges. But one of the things that was corrected in this initial pilot project was that in the initial pilot, we required that an individual have the contract for the store outlet. So in Mr. Lamb's case, his store manager came before us and was given the contract. What has changed? In 2012, with our rule change, we now allow corporations to be the agent of record. So had this rule been in effect, Mr. Lamb could have been the agent of record for Lamb's Thriftway. Another expansion of our model occurred in September of 2010. We identified an issue in a couple of our tourist areas, the primary one being in Cannon Beach. We found that during the heavy tourist times, the downtown area becomes very, very crowded. And the store actually is located in the south part of the city. So we tested a project that allowed our agent there to open up a satellite store in the downtown major area. And we found that was very, very successful because of the congestion that we had. We have a picture of the satellite store. This is our Cannon Beach store. And again, high tourist population, and the Cannon Beach store was tested and successful and is now a permanent satellite store for us. The second one we have that is currently still being tested is our Sun River North. Again, you have a high tourist area, and the location of the south store allowed us to look at putting something up in the north areas for the people that rent and go over there in Sun River. To our expanded opportunities, we have tested allowing liquor stores to sell beer and wine in addition to spirits. We had four stores that were tested over the last years, and they converted from an exclusive status to a non-exclusive status, and they invested their money into putting in coolers and investment in the beer and investment in the wine. We also had the opportunity to test four corporations, but no corporations stepped forward. We had a little bit of interest, but no corporations engaged in the test over this last year. In order to do this, it needs to be noted that the agents had to submit a business plan. It wasn't just an automatic conversion to let you put beer and wine in there. The agent had to have a business plan that outlined the value and the benefits and the data that we were looking to collect. We were looking to see if the spirits sales increased, what additional income they could generate from the sale of beer and wine. We're also looking to increase the amount of space that we sell spirits. Our primary business here is selling spirits, and we were looking to make sure that we did not decline. In fact, we were looking for increases in spirit selection. You see a picture of the Oregonian picked up on this. The test was deemed a success at the last commission meeting. Staff brought forward the information, and the commissioners agreed to allow us to bring forward more people for this beer and wine opportunity. Got a couple of pictures, some pictures down for you of our four stores. Lincoln City North. Mr. Brown has a store along the coast that's almost 4,000 square feet. And I believe that he will speak this morning to his experience and success of this particular test. The next slide is Portland Hollywood. And at the time of conversion, Mr. Miner presented a proposal that he was operating in 3,200 square feet, and he has since moved to a new location and now has 5,200 square feet of retail space. He had a pretty dramatic increase in number of spirits that were provided in the store. I think he increased by about 176 spirit products, if you will. Our Corvallis downtown store started out at 3,200, and with this test, they moved in and relocated to a store that is 5,700 square feet. So you can see that the size of these footprints is extremely large in order for people to bring in the beer and wine and make them available for the consumers. And finally, Bend West. The Bend West was a store that I had talked about earlier, about a store. He had started out as a store in a store, great success in terms of the consumer response to opening a location in that particular area. And he quickly outgrew the space that was allocated in Ray's Food Market. He acquired a lease and moved into almost 3,600 square feet of an exclusive store. And he was also and has also been a part of the pilot project for sale of beer and wine. And to complete the retail model here, we have to look to our Oregon distillery industry. You can see from the map that from Astoria to Joseph, from Brookings over to Ashland. We have 46 licensed Oregon distilleries in Oregon. They make offer about 480 products, and this represents about 12% of our overall revenue in the state. This particular industry is a fast-growing industry and is contributing to the local economies throughout our entire state. The distillery license allows the licensee to apply for a contracted distillery outlet with the Liquor Commission. We have 26 distillery agents that are operating in 32 locations. Provides for expanded opportunities for them to sell their own particular products at these 32 locations. And finally, here's an example of the distillery agent at a second location. Our House Spirits Distillery opened a kiosk post-security at the Portland Airport. It's a pretty exciting thing. They are providing consumers who are traveling out of the state with an Oregon product, and we hope to see more of this in the future.
So again, you've kind of gotten an overview or a taste of where we're at in terms of Oregon, and especially, you know, I think it's important that as certainly as I looked at this agency and somebody who sat on its budget committee when I was sitting in your shoes before, it's an important economic development engine for the state. As Director Lindsay told you, that 12% of our revenue comes from these local distilleries that are here in Oregon. They're a huge part of what we do. They're a huge part of our culture in Oregon. As we move to look at those things, we look to preserve those things as we move forward into the future at the OLCC and continue to promote in a safe and responsible manner the continued economic growth, not only here locally, but to have them grow out of state, to have out of state revenue coming back here to the state of Oregon and develop jobs and develop an industry. We're known nationally as as the place to come for developing craft distilled spirits. So those are important things. Part of the reason we've been able to do that is the way we regulate, and also the way we have the state bailment warehouse where any liquor store in the state can get split cases here of smaller batch Oregon distilled spirits, which are a substantial portion of our revenue. With that, we're certainly, as always, open for questions to from the committee to, or the committees in this case, to hear what, to answer any questions.
Questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Patridge, you've done a great job coming up to speed in a very short period of time. You mentioned that revenues have increased $16 million, or about 20%, in the wake of privatization on the Washington side of the border. Is there any reason to believe that that kind of increase could be sustained if Oregon were to privatize its liquor sales?
I think it's fair to say that the taxes went up in Washington, and certainly the pricing model got somewhat skewed in Washington, and that's what we've seen is border flee. I sit and live near the California border, so I certainly see that their tax structure is a little different than ours, so we certainly have a lot of people doing cross-border traffic. In terms of a privatization model coming to Oregon, I certainly think that it would, personally, I think that it would certainly affect where we're at in Oregon. It would certainly affect our ability to continue to provide revenue. It would also affect just long-term the revenue model that we have. As we said, 12% of our revenue comes from these local distilleries. I think in talking to the local distillers here in Oregon who've created jobs and economic opportunity for people in communities, they've basically been shut out of Washington State as a result of the change in their model because they can't get into these stores, is my understanding, and talking to the people from Washington who are operating in Washington. Hood River Distilleries, I think, has seen a major decline in its business in Washington, as was my understanding as well. So I certainly think that there's some impacts. But as you all well know, the proof's in the pudding as to how these things are structured and what privatization would really mean in Oregon under effort a variety of different models being used. So I don't want to whitewash everything with one thing. We're certainly sensitive to that, and we'll certainly, as models come forward and are defined, I think it's the job of the OLCC to be objective about what's going on and provide the legislative body with the expert opinion as to whether those really would be affected or the impacts that we would see, and we would be happy to come forth to talk to the committee about the puts and takes and looking at, you know, other models across the country. But, you know, I'm not sure what the model, frankly, looks like now. I've certainly seen letters, and people are certainly shopping models around the state of Oregon right now. So we haven't seen anything for sure in writing, ultimately. Is that... answer your question. I try to answer your question the best case I can, but
Madam Chair, if I might,
yeah,
quickly, is OLCC having any kind of econometric study here of what those potential impacts might be?
We certainly are aware of the proposals to some degree that are out there that we hear rumor of, but nobody's engaged us to look at a particular model. The Washington model, you know, if we were to look at the Washington model, we certainly could, certainly happy to come and, you know, if that model was placed on Oregon, certainly happy to come and give you puts and takes on the Washington model. From my personal opinion, I think that it certainly, if we had the Washington model come to Oregon, I think it would hurt revenue long term for the state.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have any specific questions about their presentation? We still have two other gentlemen coming up in store with pilot projects and so on with this panel. Any other questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a real quick one. The store in the store pilot project is, what's the difference between that and a non-exclusive liquor agent?
Chairs, Representative Holby, it's not different, except that it's in a metropolitan area. As I talked earlier about, non-exclusives are generally in our rural communities, and you'll see liquor in small grocery stores and in other adjunct businesses. With store to store, it was really bringing it into the metropolitan, into a larger area, and that's the basic difference between the two. It's nothing really new, but it was new in that it was, we've never had store-to-store type situations in the metropolitan areas.
Thanks.
Thank you. And I just have one question. The slide that you showed on the distribution of what the revenues are from the OLCC and the general fund to counties, to cities, and so on, how is that set? Who makes that determination?
Chair Doherty, our distribution is set in statute in ORS 471.810. It guides us through the distribution of our excess dollars after paying expenses.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you, gentlemen. Because we also have Mr. Guerra and Mr. Brown coming up. And the panel that just left, if we have questions of these gentlemen that you can answer, please feel free to jump in.
Good morning, Chair. Co-chairs. My name is Randy Guerra. I operated the Bethany store within the store from September of 2006 until March of this year. And I'm just here to share some of the experiences, some of the positive experiences, and some of the challenges that we faced with the pilot project or the store within the store project. Some of the positive things were the convenience for the consumer. I think a lot of consumers enjoy being able to pick up their distilled spirits and other groceries at the same time. From an operational standpoint, there was some security and a sense of inclusiveness of being inside the grocery store that was, I think, appreciated by our employees. Some of the challenges that we faced were, I'd say the main challenge was the limitation of space. At over slightly over 800 square feet, we're really limited. We were limited in what we could carry, the products that we made available, the logistics of stocking and maintaining products, because we had such limited retail space, we had to have our back stocked approximately 100 yards away. So it created additional expenses for additional employees and on delivery and shipment days, getting products from where they were delivered in the back area to the front of the store, the retail area, was really quite difficult. Another major challenge from an operational standpoint is the loss of additional revenue due from related items. Since we were a tenant of QFC or Kroger, and we couldn't compete with any of the items that they sold. So, for instance, we couldn't sell any tobacco products or very limited tobacco products. They did allow some premium cigars, but we weren't allowed to sell cigarettes, most margarita mixes, things like that. We couldn't compete with them in any of our related items. So it really limits the income that is available to the agent. There was also the cost per square foot. I operate another store, much larger store, and we paid almost twice as much per square foot for the space inside the QFC. So we had additional expenses, and at the same time, we were limited on our related items. So that's the experience that I had, and if there are any questions, of course, I'd be happy to answer them.
Are there any questions? Okay, thank you. Mr. Brown.
Thank you, committee chair and committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you today. I would like to give my thoughts on the
If you could identify yourself for the record, please.
Excuse me. Steve Brown, and I'm the agent at 1091 Lincoln City North, and I also have a store, 1198 Salem Battle Creek. I'm also the president, which represents the liquor stores of Oregon. I would like to give my thoughts on the test this past year of exclusive stores switching to non-exclusive stores. The driving factor for going non-exclusive was to fill a void in the market, as well as choosing products that the customers were asking for while not competing with other stores in the area. When we chose to bring in new product lines to the Lincoln City store, it was important to look at the market needs as well as the customers. After 1 year tests, we successfully achieved both objectives. The customer's reaction to the test was overwhelmingly positive. At my Lincoln City store, these are the comments that we heard from customers daily in our stores. This is such a nice shopping environment. You have everything under one roof. I wish my liquor store was like this. All we have is a small store with unfriendly people working in it. Can you open one of these in Portland? I've never seen so many choices, not only in distilled spirits, but microbrews, wines, and everything else you could need. Customers felt that the remodeled store gave them options of various product lines that were not available in any other market unless they made several stops to various stores or travel to different areas of the state. The store was remodeled, bringing in 300 Northwest wines, micro beers, and most recently a growler fill station with 11 taps of Oregon micro brews, and we also have one tap of Oregon cider. The investment to me as an agent was $65,000 for fixtures and equipment. I'd also like to make note of the test program as a whole and emphasize the four stores. While the percentage of the total beer and wine and related items were small for each store, it represented about 3.8% of their total distilled spirit sales. All four stores saw sales growth in the area of distilled spirits. Conversion stores increased an average of 12.3%. while the state average for distilled spirit sales was only 7.8%. I'll take any questions.
Mr. Lamb, do you, Bob Lamb, would you like to come up and give testimony? Sorry, we'll just keep you here.
Yeah.
It's kind of a panel. And
I apologize. You are on somebody's agenda, but not on the other people's agenda. So, welcome.
Welcome. I'm probably here more to...
You can sit back.
Okay, I'm probably here more to answer questions than anything else. I don't have anything set on the agenda, but we started out as a pilot project and treated that with great respect, and I think we've done a nice job, and it serves our community, and I just have got to know some of the other liquor agents, and these people work awful hard to make the state money, and they often work long hours and things like that, and I would hate to see the big corporations come in and take away that and take away the Oregon spirit of local. And look at all these distilleries that have jumped up that you know, really help Oregon.
Okay, Mr. Lamb, if you could identify yourself formally for the record.
My name is Bob Lamb, and I'm the owner of four grocery stores in Portland, Oregon, and we have a liquor agent who is our employee, who is our person there. We have a smaller store at Strohecker's, and then we were part of the test project that started a few years ago in Oregon.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you. Any questions of these gentlemen? Okay. Thank you very much. One of the things we were asking for now is to talk to the liquor store agents themselves. So we have Celine Nurani. And if you all can make sure you identify yourself formally for the record.
Good morning, Chair Doherty, Chair Gerard, committee members. My name is Salim Nurani, operating liquor stores in Corvallis and Springfield, and serving as the Vice President of the Associated Liquor Stores of Oregon. We appreciate the opportunity of appearing before the committee and providing details on how the business of being a liquor agent operator works in Oregon. If you need clarification during any point of my presentation, please ask, or if you prefer, we can address them at the end. In order to become a liquor store operator, first, a vacancy has to exist. Applicants are evaluated in retail business experience, including handling large inventories and cash management. Further, financial ability to purchase or lease and equip the retail liquor store at commission-approved location is considered. The applicant's ability to provide necessary funds to meet the operating expenses of the retail liquor store for 2 months, pay a resignation buyout, goodwill, and other related expenses, and be bonded is considered as well. The finalists give a presentation, and the commissioner's votes decide who will be granted the privilege of being the new liquor agent. This is the beginning of a hybrid relationship between private enterprise and the state. The liquor agents are small private business owners contracting with the state in retailing of distilled spirits, quite unlike any other controlled state. The legislature sets the commission rate for selling distilled spirits. The commission is paid monthly based on a formula determined by OLCC. The liquor agent pays all operating expenses out of that commission, including rent, payroll taxes, insurance, internet, electric, gas, etc. Any profit left over after all expenses is a net profit for the agent before taxes. The OLCC owns only the distilled spirits in the stores. The OLCC does not own the store or the building, nor is it named in the lease. The liquor agent is solely responsible for the lease and all subsequent remodeling, updating, and upkeep of the retail store. The point of sales computer system is also the direct responsibility of the agent. and OLCC does not provide or compensate the agent for the support, maintenance, or upgrade of the computer system. Any ID checking devices in the store are also the agent's responsibility. The liquor agent is not a state employee, nor receives any benefit a state employee does, like health insurance, PERS, vacations, etc. The legislatively mandated commission rate of 8.88% is split in a base pay and two different commission rates for liquor sales. Last month's report shows walk-in customer sales at 8.08%, while sales to restaurants and bars generate 6.31%. The state further allows a 5% business discount to bars and restaurants. All associated costs of delivering an order to a bar or restaurant must come out of that 6.31% commission. There is a small list of related items an agent is allowed to sell besides liquor in his store. These include mixers, sodas, cigarettes, etc. Sales from this related category accounts for less than 10% of the revenue for most stores. The agents are required to submit daily sales report in an electronic format. All alcohol sales proceeds made the previous day must be deposited in the bank within 24 hours. We are also required to submit weekly as well as monthly reports. Physical audit of distilled spirits is conducted twice a year along with an annual performance review. In 2011, liquor sales generated net revenue of a little over $94 million for the state general fund. The retailing of distilled spirits is a great source of great revenue for the state. The state has seen a net revenue increase of $26.8 million, or 29.5%, between 2006 and 2011. In 2003, the minimum wage in Oregon was $6.90. Today it is $8.95 an hour, the second highest in the nation. The liquor store agents employ more than 1,000 Oregonians. The amount of responsibility placed on our employees require that we pay much higher than minimum wage. Our employees deal with customers on a daily basis, ensuring we are consumer and customer friendly, while at the same time making sure we are making a legal sale and not selling to minors or intoxicated. We understand customer sentiment and their desire for convenience, nicer locations, modern stores, and longer hours. Most liquor stores are open 6 days a week from 10 a.m. till 8 p.m. There are quite a few open longer hours, including Sundays. Both of my stores are open on Sundays. The challenge and dilemma for most agents in moving to better locations, longer hours, and remodeling to new modern interiors is revenue. The commission and the liquor agents have a symbiotic relationship, and it is in both their interests to ensure a good working relationship. And we do. Unfortunately, since the legislature and not the commission sets the compensation rate, the agents have not been seen as a valuable business partner worth investing in. We understand the economic downturn of the last few years and the need of the state for more revenue. Sadly, the policy of not investing in the infrastructure of retail side of the liquor sales is evident in the condition of a majority of liquor stores. The commission has not seen, commission rate has not seen any increase in the last 10 years. The cost of doing business, including payroll, rent, utilities, insurance, have all gone up significantly in double digits. Our single largest expense is labor. The minimum wage in Oregon has gone up 29% since 2003. We cannot afford to give our employees decent living wages to raise a family on, not to talk about providing medical and other benefits. The commission and the legislature recognize the fact that we need to modernize the system and make it more equitable for all, the consumers, the small business owners, and the people they employ, while maintaining the revenues due for the state. The Liquor Commission is in the process of creating a small group to come up with equitable solutions to modernize the retailing of distilled spirits in Oregon. I would like to end my presentation by emphasizing the fact that we support the current control system. In order to be a viable business model for the future, both the state and the small businesses that we are, changes are long overdue. Thank you again for the opportunity of being able to present a liquor agent's perspective on retailing of distilled spirits in Oregon. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
Okay, thank you. We just wait for the whole panel's done.
Denny Stoll, North Salem Liquor, agent 1141, and also representing my wife's store in Silverton, number 1008. Currently, just past president of the also Liquor Store Association, and have been in the business for 20 years at this point.
Steve Brown, I'm the also president and agent at 1198 Salem Battle Creek and 1091 Lincoln City North.
Okay. Do you have any questions of this panel? Okay. You did a very good job. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. That ends our portion of the informational hearing.
We're going to stand recessed, and the Senate version is going down to hearing room B.
Okay. And we're going to recess until 9:30. So you guys can all go get a cup of coffee. We'll be back here at 9:30. Thank you very much.
One of them, like I say, isn't even my
I'm going to reopen the meeting on House Business and Labor for the 16th of September. Thank you very much. To continue what we're doing, the first thing we need to do is actually to, we have enough people?
We'll open an organizational meeting.
Yeah, we're going to open an organizational meeting. And Representative Kenemer, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that we adopt the House Interim Committee on Business and Labor Rules.
Okay. It's moved that we adopt the House Committee Rules, in the Interim Committee Rules on Business and Labor. Is there any discussion? They're the same ones we had before. Okay. Is there a second?
Second.
Do we need a second?
Don't need a second.
Okay. Don't need a second.
Any objection?
Gave you one.
Is there any objection? Okay. Seeing none, we adopt the rules.
Very good.
Okay. And now we will open up and close the organizational meeting and open up the informational hearing on business recruitment and expansion. So we have Joe Miles, Jody Christensen, and Chad Freeman. And if you could make sure that you identify yourself for the record, because we are recording this. Thank you.
Making sure it's still morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair Doherty, for the record, my name is Jill Miles. I work for Business Oregon. I have been with the agency going on almost 18 years as of this December. And 14 of those years, I actually served out in Eastern Oregon as a business development officer, and then 8 of the last years, I also have taken on dual responsibilities by managing our business recruitment activities. So for those of you who represent rural areas, I want to say proudly that I have served 11 of Oregon's 36 counties over my tenure with the agency, and I'm very proud for some of the accomplishments we've achieved over the years. So just to give you guys some context, 75% of inbound leads normally start with the State Economic Development Department or a State Department of Commerce. So most of those leads, if not all, cross my desk or the desk of my colleague, Colin Sears. When we work on a recruitment, one of my top responsibilities is to do the due diligence, to, you know, walk through the process with who's on the other side of the telephone. The leads can come in many different ways. They can come over our website. They can come over our 800 number. They can come to me directly. It can come through a broker that we may have a relationship with, or it can come through a site location consultant. And there are many of them out there that are managing quite a few projects. So my responsibility is to better understand what their location factors are, and there is a PowerPoint that you all have. I'm not going to walk through it, but it is a training that I do for elected officials on an annual basis through the Association of Oregon Counties. In that PowerPoint, we actually identify what some of the location factors are, and I talk that through with the folks that I'm training. But as I'm working with that inbound activity, it's up to me to really understand what their needs are. And if it's transportation related, I talk them through Oregon's transportation infrastructure. Believe it or not, we have 3 interstates in Oregon, not 2 like many people realize. We have Interstate 5, we have Interstate 84, and we also have a small section of Interstate 82. So it's my responsibility to educate that person on the other side of the phone about Oregon's advantages and understand, you know, what it is that needs to be done to possibly bring that investment into Oregon. So normally we then send out what we call a request for information to our partners. And our partners are those that do economic development. There are 150 people on our lead list that receive our leads. Now, sometimes I'm working with somebody who's very specific to geography. But what I try to do is I send it out to the whole 150 because I think it's important for our partners, and 2 of them sitting next to me, understand what kind of industries and what type of projects are shopping Oregon. So when this lead goes out, and who's on that list are people who actually practice some form of economic development. So it can be cities, it can be counties, tribal nations, port authorities. It's our regional organizations such as CHADS, as well as economic development districts. So, you know, there's many folks that get access to this, look at it, and see what's happening in Oregon in terms of recruitment opportunities. When I receive back those proposals from those who are submitting, the first thing I have to do is I have to go through it for completeness, make sure that they meet the siting criteria that's been established, and then we bundle it together with statewide information and send it on and manage the project until it becomes very geographic specific. So it may be a project that looks at the whole state, but then they've decided to, you know, do finalist sites in maybe Salem or Albany. What I do is I manage it until it gets specific to a region. At that time, I hand it off to our local business development officer. Now, we have 9 business development officers that are stationed around the state. We used to have 13, but we're down to 9. And one of the things I want to just kind of highlight before I pass the baton to my partners is we have, as an agency, continued to get by with very limited resources. The state of Idaho has, with a smaller state, they have a larger staff. They have 7 people doing business attraction. State of Washington has 6. Oregon has 2, well, actually 3, because we do have a third member of our team that is handling all the back office kind of activities.
Oh, how many in Oregon? I'm sorry.
3.
How many recruit? 3?
3. Mm-hmm. So there's 2 business recruitment officers and 1 business development specialist who supports us, as well as the business development officers. So we rely heavily on, you know, SEDCOR and the counties and the cities to kind of pick up some of that activity that we're not able to do. Leveraging each other is obviously very important. And before I hand the microphone over, I do want to make one very important point in this comment is that you can't have a successful attraction strategy unless you have a successful retention strategy. We need folks such as our business development officers, our partners such as SEDCOR and our cities and counties to be checking the pulse of our businesses. Retention returns so much more than attraction does. And if we don't have that, I promise you the companies that I'm looking to bring into Oregon are still going to want to talk to existing companies in Oregon to find out, am I going to find the labor force I need? Is the business climate exactly what my board is looking for? Am I going to have advantages being in Oregon versus another state? So I preface all my comments on, you know, taking care of what's at home is our top priority. Recruitment is obviously an important role for our agency, but we can't be successful without retention and expansion opportunities. So if it's okay with you, Chair, I'd like to have my colleagues go next.
Yeah, well, if it's okay, we'll just wait till the end for all questions.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Chair Doherty, committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. When we were asked to speak from a little bit about this subject.
If you could identify yourself.
Oh, sorry, for the record,
please.
My name is Chad Freeman. I'm the president of SEDCOR. A little background about SEDCOR. This is the Strategic Economic Development Corporation. We represent Marion and Polk County on economic development issues. We focus specifically around the traded sector recruitment and retention here in Marion and Polk counties. As many of you are aware, that includes both the urban core around Salem, but also very rural areas around both Marion and Polk counties. In our work that we have identified, the traded sector is where we get the biggest return on our investment, the biggest bang for the buck. Traded sector has been defined as anybody who competes on a national and international market. So really our core focus is trying to bring in dollars from outside by helping those existing companies that are looking at being successful with doing that, helping them grow. As Jill mentioned, a key focus for us really is the retention work, and retention is just a fancy way to help, say, helping your existing clients succeed. And that is 80% of our work here within SEDCOR, and I believe that's very similar ratio to what the state does. We've really chosen to focus on helping our existing companies because that's where you do get the return. You get the knowledge about what you're good at, what we excel at as a state and as a region, and then that helps to really influence a good recruitment strategy. With that, though, the other part that's key for us is the partnership with the state. As Joe mentioned, 75% of all leads come from the state, and that's not just in our state. That is nationwide. So for SEDCOR, it's very difficult to get that kind of exposure on a nationwide, national, international arena without the state being an active and participating partner, of which the state here, business through Business Oregon, has done a good, great example of. Kind of understanding the flow of events is oftentimes, as Jill mentioned, a lead will come to the state, is worked through, evaluated, vetted, and then passed on to partners so that we know what the trends are, what companies are looking for, how we can position our communities to be successful. And ultimately, our success ratio is in the creation of these jobs. It is our belief that these jobs are the best support for our communities that are out there, as it brings more money into the communities, helps us grow, helps us finance our schools, helps us finance our communities, really provides us the juice that we need to continue on. So as these leads come in, we then can respond as a community about available inventory, infrastructure, possibilities, how we can help these companies grow on a regional basis. Then our role is also to coordinate closely with the cities and then the counties as well about what else is needed in order to prepare for the future. So that's really a little bit about what SEDCOR's role is and how we're working with it. I'll turn over the mic a little bit to colleague Jody Christensen to speak a little bit about city as well as the role of the Oregon Economic Development Association.
Thank you. My name is Jody Christensen. I'm the Executive Director for the McMinnville Economic Development Partnership, and I'm also the current president for the Oregon Economic Development Association. I want to reiterate what my partners have said, that retention and expansion is key to economic development in rural communities. We need to know who is producing products in our community, and we need to know how to help them. The tools that we use on retention and expansion are exactly the same tools we use for recruitment. So we're not recreating the wheel. We're really strengthening our toolkit by getting in and working with existing companies and getting those resources to them. We become better marketers on those resources for those that are interested in moving into our communities. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about the Oregon Economic Development Association, an initiative we started 3 years ago. We surveyed over 85 members who represent all communities in Oregon, and we asked, how can we help you do what you're doing? What are areas that you need support? And a resounding comment came back, we need help with our food processors. We need to get better at understanding that industry sector, and we'd like to have more in our communities. So we created an initiative based on some other activities that have been going on around the state, and we created Oregon Food Processing Team. This is a collaborative effort. For a minimal investment, an organization can participate on the team. It's $1,000 per year. We leverage that money. We pool it together. And this year, our third year, we have over $50,000 of investment that we can now take into our effort. We go down to California. We hit two trade shows down there. Our mission is to connect with California companies that are on an expansion mode. They're looking for a new market, and they're physically looking to expand their facilities. We want them to know Oregon is open and ready for business when it comes to food processing. We have a team of people that go with us to these trade shows. Agencies are represented. Department of Ag is represented. We have Jill on the team, and we have multiple organizations who are walking the show and representing our group in a booth effort. It's a very important part of what a rural economic development organization can do. We have very limited funds. And my organization, for example, McMinnville Economic Development Partnership, we've never been able to take part in trade show activities. It's just not feasible. But for a very minimal investment, I've been able to be partnered with this group, and it is making us better at understanding the resources and this industry. And in our area, in the city of McMinnville, it's actually worked to our advantage on a retention and a recruitment. So, and we've used it as also making sure that we can continue to understand that industry because it's ever-changing. One of the things that we're adding this year, which we think is absolutely critical for the team, is we're going to be working with a consultant to identify specific companies in California that are ready to move. and we will be using that information as we go down to this next round of shows starting in January, and we're going to be very strategic about meeting with those companies and telling them why Oregon is a great place to do business. One of the other things that I wanted to talk about that's very important about economic development in rural communities, and that's workforce. We have to have the people with the right skills who can go to work. That's not only a recruitment initiative, that's making sure that the companies we have in our communities can grow. In McMinnville, I hear this on a daily basis. I have jobs and I can't find people. I have jobs and I can't find people. That's a bad problem. That is something that we have to figure out. And we're working very diligently to make sure that we're connecting to the Work Ready Communities Initiative. We're working with our high schools. We're working with our grade schools. We have to build our own workforce because our companies are telling us right now we can't find people. I actually had one company tell me, I don't want you recruiting new companies in our community because they'll hire people I need. So workforce is a big part of what we're doing, and Oregon Economic Development Association recognizes that, so you'll see a lot of training and resources that we're trying to get out to our members, because that is a very key initiative that we need to figure out how to help our communities. Thank you. Okay. If you have any questions, we'd be happy to take them.
Questions? Representative Fagan.
Thank you. This is a very enlightening presentation. I have a question, I think in particular for the business recruiter that you mentioned, but certainly either of you weigh in. You mentioned when trying to convince businesses to come to Oregon, you mentioned a number of concerns, workforce, infrastructure. I'm curious kind of if you had to rank them, where does Oregon's corporate income tax rate, how often does that come up, and kind of what level of concern is that compared to other concerns?
So, Representative Wagner, is it Wagner?
Fagan.
Fagan, I'm sorry.
Okay.
She gets that a lot, actually.
Yeah. There's a lot of similarities. We look a lot alike.
She's a lot cuter.
I can honestly tell you, it's only come up in one instance where the corporate income tax has worked in a negative way on a recruitment I was working on. When we're being looked at, chances are it's multiple states and multiple jurisdictions. And so many times the company or the consultant who's facilitating the process is very unemotional. What they have is they have a matrix, and what their goal is to get as many sites off that list as possible. So instead of saying site selection, it's more site elimination. Corporate income tax is a factor, but all taxes are a factor. So what they're doing is they're doing the apples to apples comparison with many different states. So that's one factor of it. Property tax is a piece of it. Sales tax is a piece of it. What we find is I get very, very few negative comments about Oregon's corporate tax structure. And I think part of it is because it's a balancing act among other taxes that are taken into consideration for a recruitment. So hopefully that helps you.
Very enlightening. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you characterize for us some of the jobs as well as the benefits schedule, the compensation schedule for which employers are not able to find an adequate workforce?
So in my community of McMinnville, we have 74 manufacturers, and those are the companies that I spend the majority of my time with. We're looking at everything from entry-level positions. Most of those positions pay between $10 and $11 an hour with full benefits. These are full-time positions. They're also looking for supervisory positions that are $16 to $17 an hour with full benefits. I've actually had companies change job descriptions from a higher level of expertise looking for entry or more of a limited skill sets, and they're willing to train someone into the position. So they're trying to be very creative. But those are primary the jobs that we're looking at. So they're entry level with opportunity for growth, and then mid-level management types of positions.
Thank you.
Could I add a comment to that, Representative Witt?
Yeah.
Chair Doherty?
Yeah, and you don't have to be so close to the microphone. We've got very good microphones here.
Okay.
Thank you.
I hear my voice kind of going in and out, so I don't know. You know, with Business Oregon, obviously, traded sector jobs are our priority, and traded sector jobs normally pay a family wage, and so we obviously want to target those specifically, as well as benefited positions. It's important to us, as well as our governor, that people have a nice benefit package, which includes medical coverage and other things. So those really are our targets and our priorities. That's all.
Okay.
I would just add that, Madam Chair, that I would hope that once we get beyond entry level of $10 and $11 an hour, that they would become family wage jobs.
Yes.
But $10 and $11 is not a family wage job.
Yep, I understand.
Okay, thank you, Representative Freeman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I appreciate the presentation, and specifically to the retention portion. I would like to mention, since it was brought up. Part of my new endeavor has me going around my community meeting with a lot of the larger employers in Douglas County, which by no means are large employers, but they're big for our area. I just was at Swanson Lumber Mill, who has Steve Swanson has four mills in Southern Oregon, and outside of supply for trees and lumber, his number one issue is tax issues, and his number one reason for possibly leaving the state of Oregon, again, besides timber supply, would be for tax reasons. So there is those out there paying attention to that. And the other thing, I'd like to also bring a different point of view on the retention portion. We recently in Douglas County had a situation where Business Oregon had an opportunity to help a business that they were working with and chose not to. That business closed down. Over a very small amount of money they owed Business Oregon, and 22 jobs, traded sector jobs, were eliminated, and that business was liquidated. So I hear what you're saying about retention. In Douglas County, the actions have been different than the words.
Questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious. It seems kind of an odd question, perhaps, but I'm wondering how you weigh or what kind of considerations you make when providing resources to an individual business that you're not picking winners and losers in an industry and providing resources to one business at the detriment to their competitors.
You know, I may, Representative Holvey, committee. One of the key things, and we obviously get that a lot, and I think one of the key determinants here, really, and that's we are competing and working directly on the recruitment and retention around the traded sector. So the programs that we work with, the path is pretty clear in front of us in many cases. What we're working with on the local time, local status, looks at, for example, would be an enterprise zone. And these are eligible for traded sector companies that are making an investment in their community. This is not picking winners or losers. These are existing programs that the path forward has been fairly delineated. But the other portion about it is with traded sector companies, these companies are not competing against each other in the immediate market. They are global by definition. So whether it's a timber manufacturer who's trying to make sales into South America, his competitor, while they may compete on a very small portion of their business, most of that is on a global basis. So really it is helping strengthen the workforce locally, strengthen the skill sets, and bring those to make us more competitive as well.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
You'll follow up, and then you were going to add to the question.
So you're saying these businesses don't compete against each other in the global market?
I'm saying they compete together, but it is on a global market, so it is they're both fishing in the largest pond possible. So while there may be they are competing, it's over a relatively limited amount of their book of business, and they both have the same game plan and the same opportunities to make those investments, if you will.
Other questions? Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. And you may have touched on it a little bit, but if you had a pie chart of all the businesses that you help versus the universe of businesses here in Oregon already, what would be the demographics, I guess? Meaning, small business, trade sector, service business, other, I don't know how classified necessarily, but, you know, do you have some sort of breakdown as to what the group of businesses you're helping are made up?
Representative Thatcher, we actually do document our activities, and we can provide that information in terms of how many recruitments and how many companies. Obviously, it's aggregate information. It's not individual information, but especially broken down by industries. So if the committee would like that information, I know we can provide that.
Madam Chair, I guess what I was looking for is the ones that you have helped, I mean, the ones that are in the business Oregon world versus mm-hmm. everybody else out in Oregon. Mm-hmm. I guess I would like to see a little comparison.
Representative Thatcher, if I may, at least on within Marion and Polk County as an example, and I think our book of business would be very similar.
Mm-hmm.
Within Marion and Polk County, about 10% of the companies are represented as traded sector, and those really are our firm targets that we're working with. So that gives a pretty clear delineation. I think there's about 120 off-the-cuff response within here. Of those 120 that we work that are traded sector jobs, I believe all but five are going to be classified as small business. We really do. I mean, as I think many people in the committee know, Oregon is a small business state. I think it's something like 97% of the companies that are there are small businesses. That's who we're working with. We work to help them compete on a global basis.
Yeah. I have a couple of questions. When we talk about, first of all, like the recruiters, now you said Idaho has 7, Washington State has 6, and we've got 3, mm-hmm. and not necessarily all of those are, you know, going out and actively recruiting. And then I noticed, and this is also in tandem with looking at the commercial properties that were in places like Ontario
mm-hmm.
and the areas that we really want to develop more in the rural areas. What would be the impact if we did have as many recruiters as Idaho of 7 people going out and actively recruiting? And
well, first of all, Representative Doherty, it would make my life much easier.
Because you are it.
Well, yeah. So the way our team works, there's myself and my colleague Colin Sears. I have responsibility for 6 industries. He has responsibility for 6 industries. So while we're still responding to those inquiries, we're trying to build intelligence around those industries and promote those industries, you know, across, well, globally. So if we had more, we would be able to detail people in and provide, rather than have 6 industry responsibilities, and maybe I'd only have 2. And then I could be much more specific. And part of the work that we do in building out those industries, such as food processing, which is my responsibility, is I'd be out in the field more, you know, looking at the industrial properties, promoting those properties, promoting the buildings, you know, building and continuing the buzz around that specific industry. So what we would do is we could probably get very much more proactive in outbound recruitment across those industries rather than trying to hit the ones that are busy right now. 2 years ago, I was inundated with data centers. I worked the Facebook project in Prineville, Amazon up in North Central Oregon, and had built a proficiency around that industry. And what I do with that industry now is I work with those communities that embrace it rather than try to force an industry into a community that doesn't want a data center. That's the kind of work that we need to do, is we need to be much more proactive and much more proficient around those industries that are top of mind for Oregon right now.
So. And then also when you were talking about the retention, it seems like one of the big parts of retention is the workforce
mm-hmm.
factor. And how closely do you work with, granted, like, we'll give you one more job to do, but how closely do you work with the local school districts? Because I know there is now more of a movement towards working with mm-hmm. the school districts on career education.
Right.
Path, which, you know, not everyone needs to go to college, but we look at, mm-hmm. at other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering whether, because I know high tech has gone to the community colleges and say, in 3 years, we will need this.
Right.
kind of a worker.
So I think that's where Jill and Colin look to the local jurisdictions and the local organizations to give them that intel, what's being done to develop workforce mm-hmm. in that community so that they can tie that into their recruitment efforts. That conversation has been going on for a number of years. How do we connect the needs of our industry partners with the education system? And it really is a systematic approach. A number of communities that you're going to find are doing that. They've tied into the community colleges. They're looking to the universities to help make those connections. We're now drilling down in our community all the way into middle school. Mm-hmm. We're trying to get to third grade. That's the goal, is we know there's some moments that can game change on students' ability to see what their path is in the future. And we're very aggressive about getting our current youth exposed to the opportunities in the manufacturing world. We want to change the conversation about it's dirty work to it's a great career opportunity. And we're being very aggressive and continuing to have those conversations with our academic partners. To be honest, it's challenging. It's challenging. We do work differently, and we speak different languages, but we're not giving up, and we're going to continue to work that. I think the Work Ready Communities Initiative, as that starts to become part of how we do our work, will be an extraordinary opportunity to change that conversation. But it's a continuous conversation, and we're going to have to come at it from a lot of different directions. And so I think you're going to find it's going to be bubbling up from the local. It's going to become regional conversations, and we know that the governor is making a commitment to this. And so we're just going to have to keep making it a part of how we do our work.
And also working with WorkSource Oregon and
absolutely.
Those for training.
They are essential to the partnership.
Thank
absolutely.
You. Okay. Good. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How much of a problem is our lengthy permitting processes to attracting new business in the state of Oregon? And how often do you experience these kinds of problems?
You want me to take that one? I'll just give you some feedback, Representative Witt. There are certain jurisdictions that have a more arduous process than others. That's why it's important for the business development officers, along with their partners, to be engaged with the local jurisdictions. I'm not going to put anybody's community on the spot here, so I'm not going to name names, but some are very aggressive. I will highlight the fact that Salem is a city that has narrowed their permitting process down to a 30-day window when other cities of similar size are 80 to 90 plus days. It hurts projects. It really does. But it's something that we can't control in terms of, you know, the leads that we get. You know, we're managing the criteria established by the company, but I have seen some companies just throw up their hands and move on to a parallel community that they're doing the same due diligence on, so which makes it very challenging when you're trying to promote all 36 counties and plus incorporated cities. So it's there are some that definitely are a challenge for us. I'll let Jeff.
Representative Witt, just to add additional to what Jill had said, the key thing is that in any project that we work on, it is time and it is certainty that helps make these things, transactions happen. And so anything that either slows down the time or adds to the uncertainty is really puts the project at risk, and we have seen that time and time again. And when you've proven as a community that you can deliver, that you do have a focus on jobs and you've taken that seriously enough to streamline the process and work with your state and federal partners to make that as clean as possible, to give that certainty there, the better off you are and the better off a project is.
I also think it's important to identify the regional solutions team as a way that we'll be able to work through some of the challenges around those particular issues.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Representative Fagan. Thank you, Madam Chair, for indulging a second question. I'm still chewing on this workforce issue just because it's a fascinating problem. And I'm curious, when people ask, particularly for recruiting or retention, obviously I know that they don't just say, do you have a workforce? And you say, yes, check, right? Like, what are the questions they ask
to input into their matrix to understand what our workforce looks like?
They often ask who else is in town. What other kinds of companies would I be competing for a workforce? They want to understand the skill set. They want to know who's educating in your community. Do you have a community college? What university? Where are students studying? They also want to understand the resources that are available through the WorkSource Centers, through our Workforce Investment Boards. They want to understand programs like on-the-job training. They need to they want that full menu of options as they're looking at how am I going to attract a workforce. They want to know what are you already doing in your community to generate that.
I'd also like to add a comment to that, if you don't mind. Oregon is special in the fact that we have labor market analysts through the Department of Employment, and as I train economic development partners that are new to economic development, my main comment to them is understand your workforce, understand the quality of your workforce. And unemployment rates do not tell the whole story, because we do have chronically unemployable people. You know, every community suffers with that. But then to wedge yourself to your labor market analyst, because that person is going to be able to do the analysis, do the reporting, build out the data that you need when you're working with a company and what they're looking for in terms of the availability and the quality of the labor. So just want to add that.
So an example of that would be in a community that in Yamhill County, we had a recruitment into Sheridan, and they wanted to know how many people leave Sheridan to go to work every day. Mm-hmm. Because to them, that's number meant we can attract that group back in. Mm-hmm. And so that was an incredible amount of data that we were able to access, and it had a map, and it had clear numbers, and that company really appreciated that. And they're now in Sheridan.
Very interesting. I like that approach, as opposed to who's leaving as opposed to who's coming in.
Right.
I like that.
Teeny weeny.
Uh-huh.
Do they ask about high school graduation rates?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's good to know. Okay, other questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you. To follow up on the workforce questions, it seems to me that our workforce and training and education is a big issue, and has been for quite some time. I hear it a lot about having a skilled workforce. And notwithstanding Representative Freeman's comments with Swanson, your information says that Oregon has one of the lowest effective business tax rates in the U.S. and has had for 5 years running. At what point, I'm hearing that we need to invest in training and education. And to do that, nobody really wants to talk about it, but to do that, we need to invest revenue, which means taxes. So have you looked around at other states to find out where is that balance of, so we're in the top five for having the lowest taxes. If we were in the top 20 for having the lowest taxes, would it impact, where is that balance point where it starts being restrictive for recruiting new businesses into the state? Is it the top 10? So that we can sort of gauge, how much can our business community, with nobody wants to pay more taxes, obviously, but we really need that workforce.
Yes.
And we need to invest in it. To do that, we need a slightly higher tax rate, it appears to me. And so businesses have to be able to accept that. So do you have some sense of looking at other states? Where does that tax rate start having industry turn away from Oregon?
If I could address some of that, and then you guys can jump in. So Oregon does not have discretionary workforce training resources. We have to, as economic development partners and practitioners, rely on the federal dollars that flow through our workforce investment boards. I think that's not a good thing. When I look at my partners in Idaho, they have a discretionary fund that they pull out of the unemployment insurance, and that's what they forward into awards to companies that are existing as well as new opportunities coming into the state. Many of the states that we compete against have a different tax structure than Oregon does, and they invest significant dollars. When we were working you know, with a project we are competing against North Carolina. We both got the expansions, but North Carolina put $4.5 million on the table in workforce training, and we had to use just the federal resources, which was a smidgen compared to what they do. So I think, you know, we, even though we're a large state geographically, we're a small state in terms of resources. And one of the unfortunate impacts of that is that we don't have a lot of resources that go into workforce training. As somebody who works with these companies on a regular basis that are looking at us, the number one site location factor is workforce. And so I think it'd be great if we can come up with a strategy collectively to try to put more investment into that. So,
And adding just a little bit, I think, and building on Representative Fagan's question as well, these are, when you talk about workforce, it oftentimes becomes a very data-driven decision. So it's those outcomes that can create a cumulative advantage, if you will. So if we're able to be in a position where we can statistically demonstrate that we have a better workforce, that is a strong competitive advantage for us to drive more investment here locally into our state and into our communities. And I think the stronger the workforce, the better, that the more competitive we are, but really in terms of it's the best way to build the future.
Because I know that I'm from the Tigard area, and Fought Steel, which is a large manufacturer that we have, was desperate for welders and metal fabricators, and they had on their reader board for 8 months, we're hiring welders, we're hiring fabricators. And part of it was the light rail that was going in, but this was something that they finally, it was a combination of the Plumbers and Steamfitters Union in Tualatin, where their training center is, and the Tigard-Tualatin School District. They're now training welders because the school district no longer had the equipment and so on to do this. And so it was a great partnership between the unions and between, and these kids are getting out and finding very good jobs and going into the apprentice programs and the community colleges afterwards. So there is a good, I'm glad that you're working all the way, because the kids are not exposed to, and I came out of it, it's a school district that had a skill center. So the kids were exposed to all different types of trades. And that, I like seeing that. So thank you. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time.
Okay. With that kind of ends our informational meeting. The one thing I was going to mention to all of you is that we do have, how many committee bills do we have?
Three.
And so if people have ideas for committee bills or whatever to that would deal with business and labor, please let us know, because our deadline is slowly but fastly approaching. So anything else? Okay, glad to see you all back. Okay, with that, I close the informational hearing for the House Committee on Business and Labor. Business and Labor.